Greetings, my friend. We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. And now, for the first time, we are bringing to you the full story of what happened on that fateful day. We are giving you all the evidence, based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Let us punish the guilty. Let us reward the innocent. My friend, can your heart stand the shocking facts about
Radio Mysterioso?
Yeah, Radio Mysterioso is back here after a hiatus of 2 weeks and some editing and putting up the Aaron Gullia show. We've got Adam Go Rightly coming on here in a second. In fact, let me turn that off, and since it's so low tech, call him here and see if he's on the Skype.
Hello?
I think he picked up.
I did.
All right. Well, let's hope the Skype keeps working. If not, I left my phone at home, so the Skype better work. Well, if not, it'll be discourteous, and we'll just continue it another time. How you doing? Huh? Yes. How you doing?
Good. How do I sound?
You sound perfect. Hey, do you have it? I'll turn the bass up just slightly on you so you sound more like your recording voice in the great 1975 hit Convoy, which we'll play at the end, I think, if I've got it. Oh, well, I can just get off of YouTube. You sent me last week or the week before your new book that you've been working on for a long time based on the extensive files, mainly, I think, of Bob Newport, about the Discordian Society, or religion, or joke, or whatever it's called.
Yes.
How did you come upon... Well, first, for the totally unhip people, which are not listening to this show, what the hell is Discordianism? And we'll be real short with that one.
Okay, it's a... First of all, Greg, how you been, man?
I've been doing good. The Dodgers won today. I think Giants won, too, actually. So there's still a game.
Yes, they did.
There's still a game ahead or something like that.
Half game.
Oh, still a half game. That's right. They would have fallen behind a half game. That's right. For people that don't know, Adam is a Giants fan. I'm a Dodgers fan. So we're supposed to hate each other.
So Discordianism, a so-called spoof religion, started in the late 1950s by a couple kids, Greg Hill and Kerry Thornley, from Whittier, California. And it emanated from bowling alley discussions they used to have. That's where they met. That's what the legend is, that they would meet in bowling alleys and sip coffee until odd hours, and they're into discussing philosophy and politics and all that. Actually, as I learned from Bob Newport, the reason they picked bowling alley was not so much for the coffees, but it was a place they could go for odd hours and actually drink, order beers and have alcohol as teenagers. And so that certainly helped the conversation. So anyway, at one point, they started this... got into this conversation about all the chaos in the world, and they get into these philosophical debates. And as I recall, Thornley's position was that basically order in the world was just the prevailing form of chaos. Such as, you know, institutions like the Pentagon were seen or portrayed as orderly, but they were had a totally chaotic function. And Greg's position was a little bit different, that there really was no order at all. It was just human perception overlaid on a totally chaotic universe. And anyway, they're going through these conversations, and at one point, you know, they said, well, order you know, there really is no order in the universe, but order has all these gods, supposedly, in different religion that created all the order and harmony in the world. What we need is a god who represents chaos. And Greg said, well, there already is one in Greek mythology. That is Eris, the Greek goddess of chaos and discord. And they said, hot damn, let's start our own spoof religion. And that's it in a nutshell. The legend behind that in Greek mythology, the Discordians called it the original snub, but in Greek mythology it's called the Judgment of Paris. And it had to do with this wedding that Zeus was putting on, wherever Greek gods put weddings on, and I'm not sure I remember all the names. I think the kids having the wedding was a guy named Peleus and a sea nymph named Thetis. I'm having to reach in my memory banks here. And so Zeus was organizing the thing, and he screwed up by not inviting Eris to the party. She got pissed off. She snuck in there, and she got this golden apple, and it had the word Callisti written on it, which means to the prettiest one. And there was all these other Greek goddesses there, and she rolled it out, and they began fighting over it. That's for me. I'm the prettiest one. So they asked Zeus to settle it. Hey, who is the prettiest one? Zeus said, nothing doing, man. I ain't getting involved in this. And he picked this guy named Paris to choose. And
A mortal.
Yeah. Yes. And the Greek goddess started trying to bribe him, and the one who won the bribe was Aphrodite. She promised him the
booty.
Paris. Yeah, booty. Helen of Troy. And so this ultimately, the other goddesses are pissed off, and this ultimately launched the Trojan War, which has ultimately resulted in all the wars in history. And there you have what they call it, the legend of the Judgment of Paris, or as it's known in Discordianism, as the original snub.
Yeah. You know, they took as their symbol the golden apple that said Callisti on it to the prettiest one. And I was thinking, since this happened in a bowling alley, do you know, somebody's going to do this now. Do you know, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Do you know how you can get a custom bowling ball made? I want to get a clear bowling ball with a golden apple that says Callisti on it.
Hey, that thought arose in my mind several years ago, too. I'm sure.
If we order two, maybe they'll be cheaper. I don't know, but I think that'd be the coolest bowling ball ever. I'd probably never use it.
Oh, hell yeah. And there's allusions with an A to Discordianism in the Big Lebowski. That
really? That would make sense, but how do you figure? How do you know?
I'm going to do some posts on this in the future. I got a bunch of bowling alley posts, but one of you see, two times in the film, on only two occasions, you see what bowling lane the dude is.
Oh, yeah.
And it's 23, and there's some other hints throughout the movie, so I have no doubt that the Coen brothers were hip to Discordianism. I can go into the story of how I got a hold of all this stuff. You were part of that.
Yeah, a little bit. I was privileged to be invited along. Please do. I mean, because this is inspiring and wonderful stuff, at least to me.
Yeah, that I invited you to an interview with Robert Anton Wilson, and it was 2000. And basically, I was helped setting up the interview because I had met this Robert Newport fellow, and that's a strange story, which I repeat again and again, but I'll just...
Yeah, I read it in the book. I didn't know how you met Bob. Go ahead.
Yeah, back in the early 90s, I read that Jonathan Vinken book, Conspiracies, Cover-Ups, and Crimes, and great book, and he had a chapter on Carrie Thornley in there. And I started becoming more aware during the zine days of Thornley. He was this crazy character, conspiracy writer, kind of befuddling conspiracies, and you heard he was an influence for the Illuminatus trilogy, and that he knew Oswald in the Marines, and Garrison indicted him as part of his Kennedy assassination. All this stuff, and I thought, what a fascinating character. Then Vankin talked about writing a full biography of him at some point, and he didn't. You know, I was kind of waiting around for it because I wanted to read it. So
yeah,
I'd been collecting material. So at one point, I had enough source material. I thought, okay, I can start this process and start trying to interview people. Well, actually, that didn't happen until I got this cryptic email from a fellow named Dr. Robert Newport. And this was in July of 2000, and this was at my private email address that nobody really knew about. He shouldn't have known about it. Friends, a couple friends and family basically used this email. And so, I mean, he could have gotten it from somewhere, I don't know. But anyway, I received this email one day saying informing me or the world that Gregory Hill had died, you know, the co-founder of Thornley with Discordianism, and this was July of 2000. I think that was the right date. And so I went, that's interesting. So I emailed him back, did you know Carrie Thornley too? Because I was thinking of writing this Carrie Thornley book. And he said, yeah, I went to, knew them both in high school. I'm a co-founder of Discordianism. And so we began corresponding, and he helped me ease the way into the Wilson interview, because he and Wilson were old friends, you know, going back to the late 60s.
Yeah.
And so anyway, that happened. I invited you along. We interviewed those guys, and Newport brought along with him an armload of material he was calling the Discordian Archives, and there was some cool stuff in there.
Didn't we see him twice? Like, first time we went to see Bob, and then the next time Bob Newport came, or was it all this all the same day? Maybe it was all the same day.
It was all the same day.
Wow, I don't know. It seemed like I saw him twice there, courtesy of you. But anyway, go ahead.
Well, what happened is we got there, and we waited around for a while, and Newport took a while to show up because he'd come across a traffic accident, so he was helping with that on the way, Hilaris, and so he was a little late getting there. Then,
oh, that's right. Then Bob said, "Let's order pizza." I think.
Yeah, and so he brought along those materials, which were cool, and so I took them home, scanned them. I thought, yeah, there might be enough for another book here. Use some of those scans for the Prankster and the Conspiracy, the first book on Thornley.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, got him the material back, and I, you know, kept in contact over the years, asking him, hey, is it still cool that I use that stuff? And he was always fine with it, you know. Then in 2009, I was coming down there when I was promoting the Manson book, and I told him, and he said, well, when you come down here, we can get together, and I'll give you everything. And I didn't know exactly what that was, and it turned out to be many, 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 many boxes of material. I think I think I showed them to you when I got them and told
you. Yeah, you were absolutely floored that you had all this stuff. I remember you're like, I didn't know I was going to get all this.
And I didn't know exactly what I had.
You had either, yeah.
Yeah. So, and not the Discordian Archives, as we're calling them now, there's a Discordian Archives East and a Discordian Archives West, and Groucho Gandhi has some stuff on the East Coast, and it's come from the collection Bob Newport gave me, which were Greg Hill's archives, and Greg Hill was pretty obsessive about saving things and archiving everything, letters, and he would date the letters and kept them very organized, so you can see on the Historia Discordia website, I've started posting some of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, got more material from other places. Some of it over the years came from stuff Louise Lacey shared with me, a lot of letters. I don't necessarily have the originals, but have the copies of all that. Then a couple years ago, I was going out to Atlanta actually spoke at Dragon Con about Discordianism. And another person I'd kept in contact with over the years was Nancy Krasner, who was Ron Bond's wife with Illuminate Press.
Oh, okay.
And when I used to correspond with Ron back in the day, he died, I guess, around 2000. We were corresponding about Thornley because he's the one who published, brought back Thornley's publishing career, basically published The Idol Warriors and a book called Zenarchy and came out with another edition of Principia Discordia.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were talking one time. He said, yeah, I have a bunch of box of stuff with Thornley's, Then he died, and I thought, I heard that Nancy was, like, selling off the inventory. And I contacted her way back then about, yeah, I'd be interested in getting a hold of the Thornley material, and I offered her something for it. Never heard back. I figured, well, maybe the offer wasn't enough, or this was just after Ron's death, so I didn't want to bug her, so I let it go. And then when I was going out there to Atlanta a couple of years ago, I had some other related questions, so I tracked her down on the web, emailed her, and it was kind of the same thing. When you're down here, I have this Thornley material that you can have. And she didn't even remember I was the one who approached her years and years ago. So we met for coffee, and she passed on a few other boxes of interesting stuff. And these were, what I gather, they were stuff Thornley had saved, and I think Ron Bonds bought them off somebody who had them after Thornley died. So those are the sources where the archive material comes from, and it's on, have it on the East and West Coast because, yeah, I was out there for Atlanta, so I didn't want to fly back with all those boxes. But I've also shared some other materials with Groucho Gandhi, Jeff, that are going to go into future projects. So that's where we're at, with the archives. They've led to these book projects and this one that came out, Historia Discordia. Really, I've been working on that for quite a number of years. I think it was I was finished with it pretty much a couple years ago, but then been working with the publisher and other issues came up, and which is always seems to be a good thing because you end up adding material and have time spending looking at it and laying it out because it's pretty complicated laying all this stuff out. As you can see, if you have that book with you there, it was quite a process.
Yes, I did bring it with me.
So that's the story of, bless you, how we got the archives and what we are doing with them.
I noticed one of the things that really caught my eye, there's so many things in here. But one of the coolest things was you found in these archives that Bob gave to you Greg Hill's copy of the original Discordian Bible.
That was the mind blower there. I told you I didn't know what I had. And yeah. It might have been...
What year was that? When did they write that? When did... I guess it was mostly Thornley wrote it, right?
No. No, not at all. It was a collaboration between... Greg Hill did a lot of writing. It was quite brilliant.
There's a bunch of his stuff in here. I mean, it's, I don't know how many pages, like 300, some 270,
287, I think.
Pages.
I didn't know when I brought I told you I didn't know what I had, and it came as a surprise one day. I might have had it, God, who knows how long, several months, because there was a lot of stuff there. Then finally I figured out that there was one section that had all the copies of the Principia Discordia.
Mm-hmm.
And, it was legend that the first edition, there was only 5 copies made and that most of them were lost, whatever that meant. They pretty much disappeared. Nobody's seen them, really, since... now, with the publication of Historia Discordia. Now, the legend behind that dude, the first edition, they started throwing around these ideas in the late 50s, but in the early 60s, they started writing up some stuff when they were in New Orleans. Both Hill and Thornley moved to New Orleans. And at that time, well, there's misconceptions here. Let me put out the misconception first.
Okay.
The legend, and this is according to Robert Anton Wilson in Cosmic Trigger, that the first edition, five copies of which were in the published with that first edition, were copied clandestinely after hours in Jim Garrison's office, the New Orleans district attorney, of course, who later went on to indict Thornley as part of his JFK assassination investigation. Supposedly, yeah. This happened in 1965 by someone named Lane Kaplinger. Okay, so that was the legend.
Who did the copying, this person, who was supposedly a secretary in Garrison's mm-hmm. office. Okay.
And a girlfriend of Hill's. It's not really clear. I don't think she was a girlfriend. She was friends with Hill.
Yeah.
And Thornley. So that's what Wilson published in the Luponics edition of Principia Discordia. Greg Hill, as I discovered, disputes that. And so I found out who Lane Kaplinger was. She's the sister of Grace Kaplinger, who is also known to the world as Grace Zabrinsky, who played Laura Palmer's mother in Twin Peaks.
Yeah, among other things. Yeah,
on all kinds of stuff.
She's been in zillions of things.
Seinfeld. And
yeah.
So I corresponded her because her and Thornley were good friends, and that's a complex relationship there as well. So
yeah.
I heard they were friends, so when I was doing the first book, I contacted her, and she got back to me, and we corresponded, and she answered some questions, so stayed in contact over the years. She's always been good about that, and so recently I thought to ask her about this legend, because her sister was Lane Kaplinger, was indeed the fifth edition of the Principia done there in Garrison's office in 1965. And she said, no, but I did copy some stuff for Greg and Carrier earlier, like 61 and 62. And it wasn't necessarily stuff that went into the fifth edition or the first edition, excuse me, but
yeah.
it was some of the material to led to that. So the legend is kind of partly true. It's pretty odd, though, that you know, that was going on in Garrison's office way back then.
Well, you can tell when you're looking at it that it was copied on an old, you know, some sort of a Xerox copier, because that's what old copiers used to look like when you had, like, large sections of black. It would just, like, white out the middle of them. And
yeah, according to Greg Hill, it was done with Xerox state-of-the-art Xerox copying at the time. He knew somebody he met in New Orleans who had and that was state-of-the-art. You didn't really have those Xerox copying machines until a few years after that.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that's the deal with the first edition. And it hasn't been seen. There was, once again, here we get into some confusion. A decade ago or so, a lot of the files came out of the House Select Committee on Assassinations.
Yeah.
And what came out of that was what appeared to be the first edition. And so, yeah, people were running with that several years ago. But what it was that came out were excerpts from the first edition, and it looked like it had been retyped. It's kind of odd. So it was pages that had been retyped of the first edition. And I assume either Thornley gave them to the House Select Committee on Assassinations or a couple other people I suspect might have, because oddly enough, crazily enough, Hell Iris, Garrison began to suspect, or he believed, that the Discordian Society was a CIA front organization, because Thornley was involved with it, and Roger Levin, another early Discordian, these other people. And he And there was an investigator by the name of Harold Weisberg who was kind of given all this material to Garrison at the time, but also started this legend. All that led, when Thornley got wind of this, he thought, we'll screw with him, Garrison, all the more. And he got Robert Anton Wilson involved and other people and launched what became known as Operation Mindfuck. That's when they created, and you'll see a lot of those Operation Mindfuck letters in the book. Yeah. They created that phony Bavarian Illuminati stationery, and they would send these spurious letters not only to Garrison, but all kinds of people like the John Birch Society, claiming that Thornley's group is the real Bavarian Illuminati, and they've come back to whatever, illuminate everybody. Yeah. And of course, that just was like screwing with Garrison, like poking an animal in a cage. That just got him more pissed off at Thornley, and he finally gave up on prosecuting Thornley. He didn't have anything really when the case with Clay Shaw got acquitted around 1970.
Yeah. You know, one of my favorite things in the book is the fake. Well, it's not really an ad. I guess it is. It's a fake Rosicrucian ad, except it's Hitler. What secret power did this man possess?
Yeah, they were picking up and they parodying, you know, those ads that were in magazines back then. You can have the power of the ancient ascended masters and all this and that. So everything was fair game with the Discordians, and that's what part of the motivation behind all of that was, to poke fun at organized religion as well as the pagan movement, you know, that was happening, and the counterculture. They were part of the counterculture, but they also saw a lot of the hypocrisy and
people taking themselves too seriously.
Yeah.
How was Adolf Hitler able to take over a whole country starting out with only 5 followers? Have you ever tried to take over even a single city block? It isn't easy. How could Edgar Cayce diagnose and cure illnesses in people thousands of miles away, people he had never seen? Why did Pythagoras, the greatest of all mathematicians, refuse to eat beans? What is the secret of Abdul al-Hazred, the visionary whose Necronomicon has been banned in every country in the world, leaving only 9 copies extant, all of them kept under lock and key in the closed shelves of a few libraries?
Yeah. See, they would leak this stuff out. I mean, a lot of this stuff made it into pretty large circulation publications. For instance, it was either Greg Hill or Wilson putting this stuff out. For instance, the East Village Other in
New York.
Sometime in the late 60s. Now, I'm not sure you came up with the chart, but you'll see it in the book there. They modeled it after a chart of the Illuminati they found somewhere, but they made their own chart, and it shows as the Master Illuminatus, one of them's Malaclips the Younger, and it has Mordecai the Fowl, who was really Robert Anton Wilson, and a number of stuff and all the front organizations. And somehow they got this to the East Village Other, and the East Village Other published it with no editorial explanation of where the hell it came from. So this stuff was going out in popular culture, and later a lot of this stuff ended up in Illuminatus, like that chart I'm talking about.
And, the chart of world revolution?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a couple of them, I think.
Well, the chart of world revolution is the one they copied their Discordian chart on, whatever they called that. But yeah, you're on the right page.
Okay, yeah, and below it is the Discordian Illuminati organization chart.
I will send you the JPEG of that Hitler Rosicrucian one if you want to post that with this show whenever.
Yes,
you
I
get
do.
It.
Yes, that would be perfect. With just the picture of Hitler too. What secret powers did this man possess? There was a parody of that in National Lampoon, except it was a it was a Popular Mechanics parody, but it wasn't the Rosicrucians; it was the Crustaceans.
And I'm sure there was some cross pollination going on. You know, I mean, more so the Discordians reading this stuff than National Lampoon was necessarily seeing anything they were doing. But
not really. I mean, it's a separate thing. But yeah, it's the same kind of idea to make fun of everybody that takes themselves too seriously.
Yeah, but you know what they were doing back in the day was. You know, it was really, really underground in the counterculture. There was, you know, that first edition of the Principia was like five copies.
What year was that? Was that like, was that before 1960?
That was 1965, the first edition.
Oh, okay. Because the bowling alley, the miracle of a bowling alley happened in 1958 or something?
Uh-huh, yep.
Yeah, and... I'm not sure, but I think I walked in the bowling alley to get food or something, and I looked up, and the first lane I saw was 23, and I believe I came running back out to tell you.
Yeah, I took a picture of it, and that was a revelation.
Yeah.
Well, there's some debate and controversy whether that's the first bowling, whether that is the bowling alley.
Right.
I based it on, we were doing that lo-fi trip to the Richard Nixon Museum.
Yeah.
And so I was going down, we were going down to do that, and I thought, hell, while we're down there, I wonder if I can find the bowling alley they talked about. And so what I did, some Google searches for Whittier. And the first one I brought up was like, whoa, this old school bowling alley, and it's called the Friendly Lanes Bowling Alley. And holy Eureka, because when Thornley was growing up, he lived by, they were building a Friendly Hills subdivision. So, yeah, the bowling alley was Friendly Hills Lane. And so I thought, wow, this was one of the bowling alleys. Talking to Newport, he was going, oh, well, it was a series of bowling alleys. But I feel this was the bowling alley where the Vision of Iris actually occurred. And so there'll always be debate, and maybe it was a number of bowling alleys, but certainly this is one they visited. And as you said, as you walk right through the door, the first lane you see is number 23.
It's just so appropriate. How did they come up with the? Because 23 was pulled off of Bob Wilson talking to William S. Burroughs about the 23 Enigma, and then the Discordians, according to your book, and I guess sort of legend that you've. Your book tends to support it, is that they had a law of fives, and the 23 just fit in because 2 plus 3 is 5.
Yeah, Wilson brought in the 23 Enigma, and it certainly worked out over the years. It came from, yeah, that was a William Burroughs thing about, I forget how the story goes. There was some...
He was in Tangiers, and he talked to the guy, Captain Clark, with the ferry, who hadn't had an accident for 23 years. And as soon as he told Burroughs that, the thing went out and sank and killed everybody on board.
Right, right.
And then the same day, I think a plane crashed in Chicago with 23 people on board.
Yep.
And that had a Captain Clark who was the captain of that airplane, and goes on and on.
There you go. Thanks. And so Wilson kind of did it, and I've picked this up reading in a few places, that originally, you know, he heard this 23 Enigma and he thought, okay, let's just feed this into culture and see if people start picking up on it. And much the same as when they started doing a lot of these Illuminati legends, you know, people, all of a sudden everybody started talking about the Illuminati more and more, not to say that they were the sole cause of that, but they seemed to press a magic button, as Wilson says in Cosmic Trigger. And the same thing was happening with 23. They kind of put it out there, and wrapped this legend around it and told, and so people started looking for 23, and of course they started finding it everywhere. But oddly enough, so did Wilson in his own life, started having all these strange coincidences, synchronicities around the number 23, including probably the most paradigm shattering, shifting, whatever thing that happened in his life. At least one of them was the July 23rd experience, where he had contact with what he felt at the time were entities from the star system Sirius.
Yes.
And so there was a bunch of synchronicities wrapped around that. He didn't know at the time. He did research on it later and discovered that the dog days of Sirius start on that day, July 23, when he had his experiences, and he found all these other people's were having similar experience to him, like Philip K. Dick and Doris Lessing. And so the 23, you know, wove itself around his life. And so that's when he got into a lot of the stuff. Who is the master who makes the grass green? He always liked to use that phrase because it's us, we, who make our own reality.
Mm-hmm.
Which I quote-unquote believe.
Yeah, well, it is. Yeah, you can. I got that from Wilson too, and then you get into the degrees which that might be or not be true.
Like, yeah,
I'm going to make my own reality, but if I put my hand in a flame, it's probably going to burn and it's probably going to hurt. There's a very high probability of that.
Well, yeah, that's part of your reality.
Yeah, if I truly believe my hand wouldn't burn, I would be, you know, I'd start a religion.
Well, yeah, it's not that.
I think they mean on a kind of a how you perceive the world and how you live your life and mm-hmm. how you keep or lose your sanity or whatever you want to call it. That's what that is applicable to.
Well, but yeah.
Sometimes people take it too fucking literally. So
no, I agree exactly. That's the whole Discordian thing, and myself getting involved in this. I didn't know where it was leading, but there's been a lot of weird magical stuff that's happened along the way and continues to happen. A lot of synchronicities. I was
yes, please.
Well, just some recent ones. I haven't documented all of these. I wish I had over the years, but recently, just working on this book, for instance, the lady who's doing the layout for it, many times this happened again and again. It was just too bizarre. We'd do some edits and I'd send them back. A couple days pass and I go, oh shoot, I forgot such and such. I better go let her know. Go to the computer and it's like I start typing the message and oh, an email pops up and it's from her about that thing, whatever
yeah.
that thing was. And this happened many times. And the other night, Rochelle Hawks, she has a collage in the book. You might have noticed that.
Yeah.
It's on Appendixia Discordia. I wanted someone to do a collage because Greg Hill was a master collage, so she helped with that. And so, yeah, just the other night on Facebook, I was wondering, hey, I wonder if Rochelle got the book. And so I went in, you know, to the little messages and was looking for her last message to me. And then I got distracted for a second. I look up and she had posted something with the book. It's wonderful. I just got it. Blah, blah, blah. And I I responded, say, to Rochelle, I was just a minute ago, I was getting ready to contact you about that. And then she went, wow, that's weird. I felt that you were wondering, so I you posted that to Facebook. Now, stuff like that, I mean, that's happened many, 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 many times, and I'm just used to it now, and I accept it. I haven't, you know, creating your own reality, you're kind of, that's what's going on there, but I have no control over it. If you try to control it, then it slips through your fingers.
Yeah, yeah. The first time you try to say, okay, I'm gonna, yeah, it doesn't work. It's kind of like
yeah.
the people that say they were trying to use remote viewing or whatever to play the stock market. Now, they could be saying this just because they don't want people to know that it sometimes works, but what they tended to say was it would work two or three times, and then if you got greedy with it, it would stop working.
Yeah, that's the wrong use for the spirit of Eris or whatever, whoever you want to, the muse, whoever you want to put your faith in. I think it's more about just putting positive energy into things, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's the, it's so many people have said this. Once you start looking at something or thinking about something or working on something and you're really sincere and you're really working hard, stuff starts shooting back at you that you didn't ask for, you didn't look for it, but it's totally helpful.
Well, exactly. With all these Discordian materials that have, you know, had no idea this stuff was all going to land in my lap. Now it's a big part of my life and will be probably for the rest of my life now because, you know, I'm the kind of the custodian of stuff. So what do you do with it? You create these books and the website and others. So, I'm working on projects unrelated to it, but there's a lot more to be done with the material. So it seems like it found the right person.
Yeah, I got a bunch of Bill Moore stuff still. I went through a little of it with Nick Redfern, and there's still probably another two or three boxes of it just sitting there.
Mm-hmm.
And there are files about Roswell. I've got tapes of interviews with people people who are no longer living about the Roswell crash. Just weird stuff like that. And I haven't done dick with it. And now you're making me feel guilty. As well you should, for no reason whatsoever. Yeah. So next time I talk to him, I want to see if he can maybe he'll help me out with some of it. I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah, what happens, you know, with a lot of the Discordian materials, Greg Hill's archives, for instance, he, the last 10, 15 years of his life, he really wasn't into it. And he didn't have that many family members, and there was no interest there, so... As Newport says, it probably would have got tossed into a dumpster if he hadn't taken it with him. And Newport, he talked about putting a website together, but, you know, people move on to different stuff, and he really got into landscape painting. That's his passion now. By the way, he loves the book and the website. He really got a kick out of it, which made me... happy. So he wasn't going to do anything with it, and forgot where I was going with this. But
perfect, Hail Eris.
Yeah. But yeah.
You just it was the fact that you took this stuff and did something with it and put it back out there and chronicled something that not a lot of people know about, and the people that do know about it didn't know the whole of it, the whole story either. The Principia, I say Principia, you say Principia, I don't know. I have a version that I guess not a Luminet, but Lupanix put out a while ago.
Yeah.
How different is that from that original first edition?
Oh, way different. I'll talk about the evolution a bit.
Okay.
So
I didn't write any of these questions down, so this is perfect. I'm getting so lazy, so damned lazy. Go ahead.
Oh, there's no reason to with this interview because it's pretty easy.
Yeah, and plus, if there's silence for like more than 30 seconds, we'll say, so how about them Dodgers or what the hell else did you find or, what about these damn whoever people that we don't like or whatever. Go ahead.
So the first edition, they took all this time to basically build this religious structure around Discordianism, and they got see, and they came up with all these different holy tracts and all this material that was like kind of a formalized weird thing, and so I had to open up the book so I can
okay. I would have people know that are listening to this and will listen to it later that a huge debt is owed by the Subgenius Church to the Discordians. And in fact, there was cross-pollination there, which we will talk about later.
Yeah. Reading through the table of contents, you have the sacred cow as the frontispiece, and you talked about the symbol of Discordianism, and it's the sacred cow, not it's a C-O-W, but C-H-A-O, sacred cow. And yeah. What that is basically the yin-yang symbol. On one side, you have the golden apple with Kalisti written on it.
Uh-huh.
And the other side is the pentagon. So those are the two. They call that the Hodge and the Podge of Discordianism.
Yes.
And the different forces of chaos in the world. So you can take it which one is the good force and which is the bad force of chaos.
Yes.
So going through this thing, you know, they just spent all this time. There's a they came up with the symbols and the principles. I'm reading out of the book here. What we know about Earth, the whole founding of the Discordian Society, the houses of the Apostle with Eris. It talks about all the different houses, the Legion of Dynamic Discord. It talks about the bureaucracy. Goes on and on and on. It's just crazy. Two crazy kids coming up with their own religion. But that was 65.
Yeah, it's amazing to read this and realize it was written then, and how extremely strange it was then, and how actually subversive it was in a lot of ways.
Greg Hill, after they published that, he went off into the army, and I have some of the letters he wrote during that period, but he was gone basically from 66 to 68 and came back and once again immersed himself in the counterculture. And they had this network of people who were part of the early Discordian society. Initially, it was just a handful of people. Then Thornley got Robert Anton Wilson involved and a number of other people. Bob Shea got involved, Camden Benares, and they all had their own Discordian names and their own little their twist on Discordianism. And so they were communicating back and forth, and you'll see some of that letters and stuff, those letters and stuff in the book. But what they started was a letter writing circle, and they passed around what they called groovy packs. And basically, Greg Hill would organize this usually, and he'd come up with maybe some weird clippings from a newspaper, something funny he'd written. Who knows? Maybe he'd throw a joint in there. And they'd have a list of people who it would go to. So it would go to the first person. They would add something, take something out, send it to the next person, and go around and around. And Greg Hill would get it back. And it was kind of like an art collage collaboration. And at one point...
Yeah, mail art. They had that. I think that was going heavy in the 80s for a while.
Yeah. And
as well. I mean, this predates it.
Yeah. But. So at one point, Greg Hill said, to hell with all the structures, you know, because he and Thornley used to have the sole authority to deign episcopos, as they call them, to make people popes in the Discordian Society. And Greg at one point said, that's stupid. Everybody should be able to declare them their own selves a pope. And that's how that those cards came about. You are now a pope because you say you are.
Yeah.
And
I think you gave me one of those original ones. It sits in a treasured place next to my Tibetan prayer wheel and my bronze Japanese Buddha.
Yeah, passed through the hands of Greg Hill, and I don't have too many of those left. When people ask me for them, I thought somebody should get one. I just, you know, why hang on to this stuff?
I am exceedingly honored, and I never wrote my name on it. I guess I should.
So... at one point, you know, they were sharing all this material, and the Principia, whatever you say, I think Greg and Carrie called it the Principia Discordia.
I think that's what Bob Wilson called it, too, I think.
No, Wilson called it Principia.
Oh,
did
he?
That's the first time I heard, and I go, that's odd, and he goes, yeah, I'm kind of...
contrarian?
Well, he's into the correct Latin pronunciations of stuff, and I said, okay. Then I've heard other people, a lot of people also call it the Principia, so either way works, but I shift back and forth. And so
I will too from now on.
If you look at the first edition and pull out your Lumponics, it's a totally different thing. There's a few things from the first edition, but it's more artwork, collage, a little weird... thing here and there, maybe something Thornley Road or Newport or Camden Benares, just a very freewheeling thing that kind of evolved. So there was...
Okay, I remember there was a page in there. It said place tongue here or something like that, intimating that they had like impregnated the page with acid, and that if you stuck your tongue on the page, you would have an acid trip.
Mm-hmm.
I stole that idea. It was on the back of one of the National Lampoons, right? On the back of one of the excluded middles. It was all the fortune cookies. Fortune cookie messages. It said, "You got the lucky fortune. Place on tongue and lie down."
I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah, I stole that from the Discordian Bible, at least that edition.
Cool. So that Lumpanics one, actually, you had the first edition. Then it started to more people were getting involved, and it was evolving. You had the second, third. And those were very crude copies, and Greg Hill is kind of coming up with the idea, I think, of what he wanted the ultimate Principia Discordia to look like, and that is the fourth edition, which was basically the last edition, kind of, sort of. So, and that was put out in 1970 by Ripoff Press, who also... did like the what they call them, the Far Out Furry Brothers, those
the Fabulous
crazy...
Furry Freak Brothers, the Gilbert Shelton did those.
Yeah, that was Rip Off Press that did that, and they did some other stuff. There was only 500 copies made of this fourth edition, and so and I have a few of those, and I've given some of those away there. I look on the internet now, and they're worth $150 or whatever. But
is that all?
That's what I see somebody trying to sell one for. But and so then that was like 70, and it was an underground classic. And then Illuminatus came out. They were working. Shea and Wilson were working on Illuminatus. You know, back then during that period, late 60s, 70s, when the Principia 4th edition came out, and they were heavily influenced. And you'll see in the first book of the Illuminatus, it's dedicated to, do you know who it's dedicated to?
Thornley.
Yeah, Greg Hill and Kerry Thornley.
Yeah.
And all throughout Illuminatus, there's references to the Discordian Society, stuff that was in the Principia Discordia, and some rare things called The Honest Book of Truth by Omar Khayyam Ravenhurst that they quote from, which was a religious tract that supposedly Thornley wrote. Nobody ever really saw it except a few passages in the Illuminatus, and a lot of people thought, well, it was just a few passages. It wasn't a real book. But once again, in the Discordian archives, I discovered the whole thing. And that's reprinted in Historia Discordia. Where was I going? So Illuminatus came out, and it's talking about Principia Discordia, and people, I mean, I read it back in the day, and a lot of it was just whoo, over my head, man. What the? They're throwing out so many things, you know?
Yeah.
Is there really a Principia Discordia and all these other weird, The Honest Book of Truth, and by people with weird names, Omar Khayyam Ravenhurst and Malaclips the Younger? And so I guess Michael Hoy with Lumponics was wondering too, and somehow he got a hold of Greg Hill about a year after the Illuminatus trilogy was out, and he found out about the Principia. So that's when Lumpanics brought it out, which is the copy you have. And they actually published two versions of that. You probably have one with a yellow cover,
yes,
right?
Yes, I do, yeah.
Great. And Greg, the intro is by Robert Anton Wilson, and Greg Hill did an afterword, which was added on to that. There's actually another Lumpanics edition before that, which I have, which is just a white cover, and... it had Michael Hoy did a little introduction. So that's where it really got into popular culture. But wait a minute. I just remembered. between those, between the Ripoff Press and the Lumponics, I had heard about another edition, which was a hard copy, a red cover. And I thought, well, Greg Hill probably wasn't involved in that. And I recently did a video about all these different editions, and I failed to mention that one just because I'd never seen it. It's really damn rare.
Yeah.
And somebody emailed me and said, hey, what about the I'm forgetting what they call this edition. Let's just call it the red cover. It was named – there was a
– the Little Red Book edition.
Publishing really small, weird publishing company that put out a couple things in New York. So anyway, this guy who contacted me says, I have two copies. I'll send you one. So I got a copy of this.
Oh, there's your siren.
Of course.
There's a bunch of them. They must like this part.
Hell Iris. Oh, Hell the 40.
All right, go ahead.
So I'm getting off on a tangent here, but there is this other hard copy edition that came out between the Ripoff Press and the Lumpanics thing, and it was published in New York. A couple hundred copies, something weird like that. There were some weird rumors around it. One guy I know bought it in a bookstore in New York, and he was saying that it was published by the CIA. And why'd you ask him? Because there was a little sign there that said published by the CIA was behind it. So all these weird rumors about it. But the odd thing is that Greg Hill lived in New York during that period, so I'm sure he was involved with it, is my guess. So anyway, that's kind of the editions of the Principia. Then Steve Jackson Games came out with one. You know, he was the dude who put out the Illuminati card game based on Illuminatus. And he put out another edition of Principia, and he added other new stuff to it. And that, once again, got it more out there in popular culture. And then in 91, Illuminet Press did it. Then there's been other efforts since then, and some people really fucked it up. There's one Ding Dong who removed all the artwork and everything, and this, you know, took the text and put it on whatever, Amazon, to sell, because the whole thing with the Principia Discordia was it was published under copyleft, which was basically all rights reversed. Anybody could republish the thing, and so some people have taken it upon themselves to put out some really inferior editions of the Principia Discordia. And if you go to Amazon, then each you don't know exactly what you're going to get a lot of the time, because if it's called Principia Discordia, it's going to have all the other reviews from everybody else who's reviewed every other edition over the years, you know.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's the deal on the Principia Discordia. Pretty good, damn convoluted, and I think I'm the person who's been able to make the most sense of all of it so far. And we do have these other editions of the Principia Discordia, which we'll get out to the public at some point. You know, I like to do book projects first, just because that helps keep this process, funding the archives and everything, maintaining it, moving it along, you know.
Yeah.
And, of course, everybody wants everything now. I had somebody asking me the other day for, hey, could you send me the digital copies of the first edition? I go, well, no. I've got an agreement with a publisher, and once you let the genie out of the bottle, you know, I want this book to do well. Not only, you know, I'm not going to make tons of money off this book.
Now that you've done all the work and put all the work into this and located all the stuff, can I have this stuff for free so that I can make money off it? Thank you.
And I feel an obligation to the publisher, too, to make this successful, you know?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I mean, why put all a bunch of effort into something just to have it just be a money drain? It's nice to... you didn't do this so you could be famous and have lots of money. Although, I don't know, if it happened, that'd be great. The only reason any of us do any of this is because it's fun.
Exactly, yeah.
And if anything comes out of it, that's icing on the cake, you know? Anything good comes out of it. Even if you just meet new people, you know?
What's that?
Even if you just meet new people, I mean, that's just enough reason to do it.
Oh, yeah. And then a few years ago, when I first got some of this material, I put it out on the web. We started a short-lived website. The guy named in Australia named Dr. John Swaby helped me out. Threw some of these materials up there. Then I saw real quickly that, you know, people were taking them and posting them willy-nilly without the context of what this was all about, and I kind of saw where it was going. I said, nah, let's just shut down that website. I want to put this together in a book with the right context. And afterwards, I found out that material was taken, and it was mixed with the pages from the House Select Committee on Assassination that were part of the first edition. All that was kind of slapped together willy-nilly. And
what'd they call that?
The Holy First Edition. It's out there, so a lot of people thought that was the first edition. So, and it's material that's from, you know, there's some early material, but a lot of it's years later, had nothing to do with the first edition. So it caused a lot of confusion. So I felt, part of my job here is to be as historically accurate with presenting this material as I can. I know it's a weird, crazy subject that people don't know whether they're taking it seriously or not. But when I post stuff, I try to put the background and show who presented it and what year it was published and, you know, what went into all these different Discordian activities to put it in the correct historical context. And the problem is it's Discordianism that people take this stuff and run around and create their own legends with it. You'd have to be part of the Discordian community to understand exactly what I'm talking with, but it's ripe for Operation Mindfuck, which is okay too, because this is Discordianism, right?
Yeah, I mean it's a wonder with everything that's going on with the Discordian society and what all the changes it's been through that even exists anymore, or even that people even know about it or care or anything, because it's just so. I don't know. I guess that it, you know what it is? It's an attractor. It's a strange attractor. It attracts weirdos.
Oh, it attracts across the spectrum. People hate each other, have totally different political leanings or whatever, you know. And that's the thing with Discordianism. Greg Hill once said, we Discordians must stick apart. And we certainly do, but it's a worldwide movement. There's a fellow by the name of Brenton Clutterbuck, and that's his real name. He's an Australian lad, and he's writing a book called Chasing Eris. And he spent the last couple of years going around the world and interviewing Discordians. Interviewed me when he was over here in the States and a few others, and I showed him the first edition. And actually, he's one of the quote-unquote staff members at the website. Occasionally, he's posting material that's going to be in his book. But, yeah, it's a worldwide thing. It has a huge presence on the Internet. I mean, there's a dude in Brazil who's been translating some of my Discordian-related stuff. He's also translated the Illuminatus, and you have him. Yeah, the weird thing is it shouldn't surprise me, with this Historia Discordia website, I get in and check the stats periodically, and there's a huge international audience all over the place. It blows me away. I mean, not only in Europe, but across the globe, Russian or African or you name it, that kind of blows me away.
Yeah, they probably think it's a CIA front.
Oh, and we also get occasionally the Department of Justice looking in, and it was actually traced back that somebody did this that was coming from the White House. This has happened a couple times, and with it, you know, you can tell how long they were looking. They're only there for a couple of seconds, but somehow they were led to Astoria Discordia, so it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, well, then you also see how long people are on and how many different things, links they click on and all that other stuff to get your stats. I never really look at that stuff for Radio Mysterio, so I guess I should. I mean, I see how many people download stuff, but that's about it. I don't really care. I mean, I just and how long has that site been up?
About towards the end of last year, we launched it around the time of the Kennedy assassination.
So anniversary. That's
like November of the last year.
Yeah, November 22nd or so.
And it's been doing good. Got a write up in Boing Boing, so.
Oh, good. Then you had like a zillion hits in one day when it got written up there.
Uh-huh. And it's maintained. I mean, there's a pretty hardcore audience that's into this stuff. And, you know, part of it comes from Illuminatus and Robert Anton Wilson, people that got into Discordianism. So there's a pretty large audience, and there's been a lot of enthusiasm for this book. And it's...
Here's a second one.
Hell Iris. Hell Discordia.
They all slow down here so you get the full effect. And I put the I pointed the microphone out the open window.
I could tell you were doing that, yeah. Sounded awesome.
Especially on this show about this book and about these people and about this subject, it's perfect. Do you want to broach the subgenius Discordian thing?
Oh, I can just... pass on what I, my interactions, basically Sting, he doesn't like me, but
I think he fits. Why not?
Well, it goes back with the Prankster book. You know, he had the picture with Carrie Thornley fucking a chair.
Yeah, that's a great picture.
Yeah, and I love Ivan Sting, some of the stuff he does. It's hilarious. But anyway, so... I contact him, hey, I want to use that photo for the book, and he said it was cool, you know, so I send the Prankster and the Conspiracy. And so then I sent him a book when it got published, and it didn't hear back. Then I saw on the web later on he was going, Gorightly's trying to make out that Thornley would have this huge part in Discordianism and all that. I think he felt slighted, you know, that, and he had some run-ins with Thornley because I said basically Thornley was a major player in Discordianism. That's all I said then.
In Discordianism or the Church of the Subgenius?
I'm sorry, in the Church of Subgenius. Okay. And actually, you know, Thornley was published in some of their magazines, and he was writing. In fact, I have one piece in Astoria Discordia.
Yeah, I saw it's near the end there.
Yeah, it's called Mastering Slack or something about that. So Thornley was into that, and they had a falling out at some point. But then again, you know, and I heard one interview with Sting was interviewing Wilson, and he called Thornley one of the great subgenius saints and all this. So I was this, you know, pretty free and easy. In the 80s, Thornley became a major player in the subgenius society. And that's all I basically said. And Sting really didn't like that reference. And he thought he'd given Thornley all this credit. We're the impression I get, we're the ones who's doing all the work, you know. And he really doesn't give much credit to Discordianism. He says he didn't really
Maybe that's just a personal thing with him, because it's basically mining a lot of the same things. It just took that and just ran forward with it insanely into the next generation.
Yeah, and maybe he I don't doubt him, maybe he hadn't heard anything about Discordianism. So
right, maybe he hadn't, but eventually I'm sure he did.
Oh, of course, yeah. Well, he knew
he knew Thornley, so yeah.
And Wilson is well, but I think he doesn't like people suggesting that they've took all their ideas from Discordianism. Obviously, you know, there's some
they didn't, but it's, you know, there's some cross pollinate. There's a if there's a Venn diagram, there's a little bit of crossover.
So yeah. Anyway, that's the rub there. I got nothing against Ivan Stang per se either. Either, you know, besides he has a feather up his ass about me, but that's okay.
Well, I hope I didn't start one by talking about it. I'm not going to take this part out. I'll leave it in.
Oh, yeah. No, that's what he, I'm sure he doesn't care what the hell I have to say anyway. But
yeah, but I want him back on the show at some point because we never finished our interview because the something went wrong with the phone line and we got cut off. When I had him on, it was terrible, and he was hilarious too. I mean, you—if you listen to that interview, if you listen carefully, you can hear me laughing through most of it. Yeah.
And I wrote a little piece about that on Historia Discordia. We posted this interview Stang did with Robert Anton Wilson back in '85. Pretty good interview, and I talked about how he was kind of pissed off about whatever. What came out in the Prankster and the
Conspiracy.
Prankster,
yeah.
And the Conspiracy, and my closing lines were, I consider Ivan Stang a great American, even though he gets a bit whiny at times.
Well, he's never been that way with me, but I don't know him that well. So,
there's a funny story, and this didn't relate to me, but
Well, you know, abbreviated.
I'll tell it in just a thumbnail. And there was a convention in Atlanta, one of these cross conventions that's like a fringe festival. And I had some friends there who got into the event, and they kind of schmoozed their way into an event and got free passes. These were just a couple young kids at the time, and Stang had to, whatever, buy his pass or something. He saw these young kids with passes. He goes, "What the hell? Why'd they give you those passes for?" He was kind of pissed off. And my friend, these young kids, were kind of laughing about this. And they had all the Subgenius were putting their posters everywhere. So everywhere they saw a Subgenius poster, they'd go and tear it down. And Stang saw him tear down a couple at one time, and he was chasing after them. He was all right. So. It's a weird community.
Discordians, yes,
and Subgenius. Makes the world a better place, though, I think. Yeah, and I'm friendly with some of the Subgenii on Facebook, like Hagen Brenner and Philo Drummond.
Yeah, I think I'm, Facebook Philo, buddies. I do not know him too well, and I haven't talked to a lot of these people in a very long time. But yeah, at a very impressionable time in my life, they were heroes to me.
Can we take a break and you play Convoy, and I got to blow my nose here.
Oh, okay.
And go to the bathroom.
Let me see if I can find Convoy. You can go ahead and do that. You don't have to wait for me.
All right.
Here's Convoy by C.W. McCall, a.k.a. Adam Gorightly.
Yeah, Breaker 19, this here's a rubber duck. You got a copy on me, Big Ben, come on. Yeah, 10-4, Big Ben, for sure. By golly, it's clean clear to Flagtown, come on. Yeah, it's a big 10-4 there, Big Ben. Yeah, we definitely got the front door, good buddy. Mercy sakes alive, looks like we got us a convoy.
Was the dark of the moon on the 6th of June in a Kenworth hauling logs. Cab over Pete with a reefer on and a Jimmy hauling hogs. We is heading for Bear on I-10 about a mile out of Shaky Town. I says, "Pig Pen, this here's a rubber duck and I'm about to put the hammer down.
'Cause we are little
back off them hogs. 10-4, about 5 mile or so. 10, roger. Them hogs is getting intense up here.
By the time we got into Tulsa town, we had 85 trucks in all. But they's a roadblock up on the cloverleaf, and them bears is wall to wall. Yeah, them smokies as thick as bugs on a bumper. They even had a bear in the air. I says, calling all trucks, says, here's the duck. We about to go a hunting bear.
'Cause we got great big
Big Ben. Negatory, Big Ben. You're still too close. Yeah, them hulk is starting to close up my sinuses. Mercy sakes, you better back off another 10.
Well, we rolled up Interstate 44 like a rocket sled on rails. We tore up all of our swindle sheets and left them setting on the scales. By the time we hit that shy town, them bears was getting smart. They'd brought up some reinforcements from the Illinois National Guard. There's armored cars and tanks and jeeps and rigs of every size. Yeah, them chicken coops was full of bears and choppers filled the skies. Well, we shot the line, we went for broke with 1,000 screaming trucks and 11 long-haired friends of Jesus in a chartreuse microbus.
Yeah, rubber duck just sodbuster. Come on there, yeah, 10-4 sodbuster. Listen, you want to put that microbus in behind that suicide jockey? Yeah, he's hauling dynamite. He needs all the help he can get.
Well, we laid a strip for the Jersey Shore, preparing to cross the line. I could see the bridge was lined with bears, but it didn't have a doggone dime. I says, Pigpen, this here's a rubber duck. We just ain't going to pay no toll. So we crashed the gate doing 98. I says, let them truckers roll 10-4.
Buddy, we're going to back on out here, so keep the bugs off your glass and the bears off your tail. We'll catch you on the flip-flop. This here's a rubber duck on the side. We gone. Bye-bye.
Yep, that's me, all right.
If anybody wants to know what Adam Gorightly was doing in 1975, he was providing lead vocals for Convoy under the name C.W. McCall, which is also there's three levels there. I think C.W. McCall is also a pseudonym if you look it up. But if you see this on Wikipedia, don't believe the lies. It's Adam Gorightly there doing the vocals.
That does sound a hell of a lot like me, especially when I put on a little southern twang.
Yeah, like like Colonel Beauregard.
Yeah. Beauregard.
Nobody has posted it. Colonel Beauregard hasn't said anything in a couple of months here. I think he's going to have to get wake up here and start talking again. This is a character that we discovered when we were on a trip in the South.
We channeled much like, you know, George Van Tassel did back in the day.
Yeah, there'd just be something on the street, or we'd get, like, bad service, and, you know, suddenly he would, like, come up through the subconscious, you know? In my day! Service like that would be met with the back of my hand, sir! You know, stuff.
Takes me a bit to get into character. But once you do, you can't shut up, and our wives are going, oh, God. You guys going to keep doing this the whole trip?
I resent your accusation, madam.
Ma'am?
The one that I remember most fondly was that lesbian talked to us for about an hour. And it was it was a lot of fun talking to her. She was on a trip with her mother, I guess. Around. She'd been to more states in the United States than I ever will. I think she said she'd been to like 48 states or 47 or something.
That's right, yeah.
And she left, and there was a little bit of a pause. And I turned to you and said, that young man's mighty peculiar, you ask me.
Yeah, I don't know if I'll make it to all the states. I've been to quite a few, but...
Are you being sent anywhere on book tours for this, or being asked to lecture anywhere for any of this Discordian stuff? Oh, I got a good question, and I'm sorry to bring it back to the Manson thing, but were you at, did you go on book tours for Manson, and what was the strangest or most off-putting thing that happened to you on one of those?
No, I didn't do that much. Just in 2009, we did the Soap Plant Wacko one. That was a lot of fun. Got a big turnout. Then,
yeah,
that was a real good one there. I mean, nothing weird per se. I did also did around that same time. What the heck's that place? There's another one. Oh, hell, I forget the name of the bookstore now. Not too many people showed up for that. I'm trying to remember, but...
Oh, that was Book Soup.
Book Soup, yeah. A few people... Oh, you came to that, yeah.
Yeah, there were... I don't know, there's about 10 or 15 people there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I never got any weirdo cornering me or anything, so...
Lucky.
Yeah. Yeah, one thing that's coming up, and I'm waiting to hear more about it, I was asked... By are you familiar with this whole cosmic trigger play that's going on? They've been raising money for.
I've been seeing the appeals that you have been forwarding. Yes.
So I'm been communicating with these folks. The lady who's putting it on is Daisy Eris Campbell. Yes, her middle name is Eris. And she is the daughter of Kenneth Campbell, who did the Illuminatus play back in 1977. And there's...
In Scotland or Ireland? Or in Ireland, actually?
No, in Liverpool and London, I believe. They came over and did it in Seattle. And Kenneth Campbell's pretty well-known dude. And it was a several-hour play. And actually, in Cosmic Trigger, Wilson writes about it. He went over there and performed in one of the, what do you call it, one of the parts of the play where he actually stripped naked was his role. And to get up the nerve to do it, he took some acid and passed out acid to other people. It was a very loosey-goosey thing and quite memorable. If you look up the Illuminatus, the stage play, it's historical. And Ken Campbell, Kenneth Campbell's pretty well-known.
Uh-huh.
So at that... stage play, one of them back in 76, Kenneth Campbell, who directed it, the character who's playing Iris in it, and her name is, her name. That's Daisy Iris's mother. Daisy was conceived between acts of the Illuminatus trilogy play, stage play back in 76. And so this has been a part of her life for a long time, and she's quite an admirer of Robert Anton Wilson, and went through her own Chapel Perilous along the way.
Yeah.
And she's a pretty successful stage director now, whatever you call them. And at some point, the stars lined up, and she got the idea to do this, the Cosmic Trigger play, which is basically a play based on Robert Anton Wilson's life and the book Cosmic Trigger. Also, there's some scenes from Illuminatus, and also she references my Prankster and the Conspiracy book. So we've been in touch. I've had a chance to look at the play, and she has done just a... awesome fucking job. And I told her that, and I said, I'm not blowing smoke up your, you know what, you really weave together all this Chapel Perilous that was Wilson's life in, you know, an amazing way, because she went through the same stuff. So anyway, she asked me, the plan was, you know, before they started the fundraiser, she was looking for people to go speak over there. They're kind of kicking around the idea, okay, we're going to do this play. Let's have a Bob Festival. So she asked me to go over there and speak. And it was incumbent upon, you know, how much money they raise if they can be able to fly speakers over there. They were looking at raising 23,000 pounds, and they exceeded that. So
wow,
looks like I'll be going over there for this festival, which is going to be in November. the play itself, it's like over the days of November 21st through the 23rd. The play will be on the 23rd. Everything's been based around fives and 23s. And
yeah.
She said when we talked before, she wanted me to talk about Thornley on November 22nd. Once again, I'm sure she's probably aware of the relevance.
Yes, definitely.
November 22nd. So that's the only thing I have on the horizon. And I'm looking forward to that. It's going to be the first one. Play's going to be in Liverpool. So all this money they've raised is to fund the festival and the play. Then after that, from ticket sales, they'll try to keep the play going and try to eventually bring it over here to the States, I think, is the plan.
Uh-huh.
Right now, they've just finished their fundraising, so they're ready to, you know, she gets a whole crew behind her, go to phase two, you know, and start pulling all this stuff together.
Right.
So there's a renaissance of Bob and Discordianism. My book came out, and this other lad, Clutterbuck's, doing his book, and so a lot of things going on in the world of Bob and Discordianism. When I say Bob, I'm not talking about the damn subgenius Bob either.
Damn subgenius Bob. I always thought it was fun that Bob is the same, that Bob is Bob Wilson Bob Newport. And Bob Jobs and Bob Shea, and there's a holy gathering of Bobs somewhere.
There's another with the early subgenius. Now I'm getting that confused with the early Discordians. there was another Bob McElroy. He was like, you know, the first dozen or so. So half of the early Discordians were named Bob. So there's clear evidence there that the Church of Subgenius took all of this from Discordianism.
Did you see somebody posted an ad from a 1950s, I think, newspaper for?
Oh yeah.
Did you see that? That was amazing.
Yeah. That was it. That was the Holy Grail. Even Stang commented, said, "Bravo! That was a hell of a find." I'm sure he didn't. Even the guy who did the artwork, it was one of those guys, Philo Drummond or whatever. They weren't sure where it originally
yeah, and this wasn't even a drawing. It was like a photo of a guy, and it looked exactly like Bob Dobbs. And I think Hagenbrenner said, this is proof that this exact person actually lived and breathed and walked the earth.
Yeah, I actually, when I saw that, I might have got it from Hagenbrenner or somebody, and I reposted it, and yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, I think if you like Google real Bob or Bob in ad or something like that, it might come up. But
who the hell was that dude? It'd be great to find out.
It was Bob.
Oh, it was just Bob.
It was an incarnation or something. Who knows? But it's funny. It was exact right time period and everything.
Well, it's scary because you have the photo of the guy, and it's the Bob Dobbs is a little bit different, you know.
Yeah, just slightly, but it was that was like a little like, you know, a generic illustration for advertising, and then there's this photo of this guy looks.
He
could have been the model.
He's just beaming with enthusiasm, you know. Yeah. He has the pipe in his mouth, and he's on.
It was a Father's Day ad. You know? That's it. Yeah, it was like.
Oh, I noticed something in there that it said something about slacks. If you look at it, it'll say, you know, it's selling shirts and slacks.
I think you may have pointed that out on the thread. Yeah, perfect. Let's see. We've got... oh, my God. It's only 9:37. Well, that means we have 23... We have 23 minutes left here, Mr. Adam Gorightly. Just as I look at the studio clock here, which isn't exactly right, but...
We can talk about whatever you want. We've beaten this book to death, which you can get on Amazon.
Yes,
Historia Discordia, The Origins of the Discordian Society. I made up, you know, we have the website, historiadiscordia.com. Go there, and I made up a Facebook book page that as well, if you want to have updates of what's going on with the book. So seek it out. Yeah, if you're interested, buy the book, and that's the plug.
Thank you. Yeah, see, I didn't even mention the book at the beginning. That's how disorganized I am, Hail Iris.
All hail Discordia.
All hail.
How does the book look, though? How does it feel in your hands? How's
it's a nice, big, fat book. It's got some weight to it. It's not too big. The cool thing about it is when I'm looking at the reproduction of the first edition of the... It's called the Discordian Society. It just says that on the front. And then on the title page, it actually says Principia Principia Discordia inside. But if that was done on a copying machine, I suppose that would be a facsimile reproduction of it.
Mm-hmm. That was kind of the idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would have loved...
Because it's an 8.5 by 11 book, or whatever the book size is. It's close to 8.5 by 11.
I would have loved, and maybe at some point we could do like a real coffee table hard... bound color reproduction, because it's in black and white, and there's so much more going on with color, with this material, but one step at a time.
Yeah. Hey, why do you keep writing? What the hell's wrong with you? How can I get that back there, Adam?
I'm mad, I tell you, mad.
Well, what are you mad about?
I'm crazed.
Oh, okay.
No, I just, especially the last couple of years here, it's become a routine,
You're turning into Nick Redfern here. Every time I turn around,
exactly.
There's almost...
I look forward to it when I go to bed at night. It's like, oh, man, I'm ready to let's get this sleep done with so I can get up first thing in the morning and write, So it's just, as we talked about, I said it's just something you need to... do every day, whether it's 5 minutes or an hour, and so whatever. I got I've always been into writing.
The last time I felt like that was when the magazine was going.
Mm-hmm.
Where I just it took over my life and I couldn't do anything else.
And I've got
and work and sleep were just got in the way.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you get the idea in your mind of what you want to. Get done, and you're driven to do that. So I got a bunch of projects I'm working on. So this has got to keep for me keep the ball rolling and writing every day. It's like working out, flexing muscles. It just you got to do it every day to continue to get better at it, and get a rhythm going. And it's hard because. It's like I remember working on. I have a book on James Shelby Downer that did a few years ago, and people like it, but it's a very slim volume.
Yes, but it was needed.
I remember working on that book and some other projects. If you don't stay engaged with the writing project and let things sit for a while and go back to them, it's like, man. I can't even get into the right frame of mind I was at when I was writing about this before, and I've lost the energy for it. So I think that's one of the pitfalls. If you're going to start a project, you just got to keep that energy. So, I'm into it. I'm enjoying it now. I know you've talked about it's a struggle sometimes to write.
Yeah, I'm trying to get I'm trying to get Go Rightly here to kick me a little bit more. And it's sort of working, but I've still got a way to go to being obsessed again. Because when you're obsessed, nothing can stop you.
I don't know if you need to be totally obsessed.
Well, that's my word for it. But it's like you said, that you think that sleep gets in the way of you getting up and producing some more and doing whatever you need to do. Some people call it obsession. Some people call it something else. But the same feeling.
Not to say I don't have a life, and if I got something better to do one morning, I don't.
No, of course. I mean, if I have a choice, somebody says let's go paragliding, or I'm going to stay home and write. I think I'll probably go paragliding, but that's a normal writing thing.
Yeah.
It's like you do everything you can not to write until something is kind of due, and then but you're doing a little bit all the time.
Yeah, I think for me, like I said, it's just even if you're spending. a minute. Open up whatever you're working on. Because I find a lot of times you just get in there and you get, okay, you get interested in writing again. And, oh, an hour went by and cool, got something done there.
Yeah. Yes, I remember this at some point. I have known this feeling. There was a great post somebody put on from the what's the guy's name? Chuck Putt, I can't pronounce his name. The guy that wrote Fight Club.
Okay, yeah, I know the dude you're talking about. I can't pronounce his name, but yeah.
Paul Anik or whatever his name is. Anyway, there was a post by him somewhere that somebody had forwarded, and it said, you know, tips for writing fiction. And one of the ones was, don't ever say somebody thought something or remembered something. Mm-hmm. Describe what that is, and if the character has a desire or something like that, give the reader that desire. Don't describe the desire. Put that desire in the reader's head. And I thought that, you know, it seems kind of normal and, you know, obvious, but I thought it was absolutely brilliant advice.
Well, and, you know, one thing with writing, write. Don't examine what you're writing at the time, whether it's good or bad, because you can always go back and get rid of it. And you should be going back and looking at stuff and saying, okay, that's garbage or whatever.
Most of the time you go back and look at it, and at least for a little while you're going, what the hell was I thinking?
But I think mistake I've made, I got have this nature, it's the same thing around the house, that I need kind of a tidy environment. It's kind of like what I have on my computer, whatever, there'll be old stuff, and I'll just want to clean house, get rid of stuff, and there's, you know, it's better just to keep everything. If it's bothering you, put it in a file somewhere. You won't see. I remember I had a idea about a second Carrie Thornley book called Carrie and the Little 5 Points, because I'd interviewed people after the book and they had stories about Carrie. So I started putting the book together, and it was just a few pages, and then years passed, and I'll never write this. Delete, whatever. Now it's stuff I could use for the website or whatever. And I always find this. I'll write something. It's like, well, I'm not feeling this, but it's better just to save things, and you can repurpose them maybe in another form at a later date.
Yeah, musicians do that quite a lot. I guess any continuously creative person may do that. I just read a book about Paul McCartney in the 1970s. I don't even know why I would think to read that, but I just read a little excerpt from it, and then I voraciously read the whole thing in like a day and a half. And it was just about when it's like starts right when the Beatles are breaking up, like within like 6 months before the Beatles are breaking up, till, and it ends with his pot arrest in Japan in 1980 or 81. And it's absolutely fascinating to me to see, you know, whatever your opinion of Paul McCartney is, just like how his life turned out, what he was doing, who he's interacting with, what he thought he should do. The fact that his, you know, everybody's like, why was Linda McCartney in the band? She couldn't sing. She couldn't play keyboards. He had her in there as kind of a security blanket.
Yeah. Sure.
I didn't really, never really thought about that. And people's like, what do you have her in the band for? And he basically said, fuck you, she's in the band. It's none of your business.
Yeah, you could barely hear her on the keyboards anyway. Chill out. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And it eventually, after a few years, she got better at it, and that's fine. But he just needed her there for whatever reason. And because she was there, we got, you know, another 10 years of incredible stuff out of Paul McCartney. So.
Oh, well, people want to hate. They want to whatever. You know?
Yeah, and there's a lot of little fighting here and there. And the other cool thing I got out of that book was, which was kind of, it should be obvious to most people, it wasn't to me, is that all through the 70s and after, people kept saying, when are the Beatles going to get back together? Why don't you get back together and do an album? Why don't you get back together and go on TV? You know, there was that thing on Saturday night where, who's a producer? Lorne Michaels came on and said, here's a check for $3,000. Says the Beatles. You can give less to Ringo, whatever you want to do.
Yeah.
And the funny thing was that like four blocks away or whatever, McCartney and Lennon were sitting in Lennon's apartment watching that.
Yeah.
And they were kind of stoned. They were like, you want to go down and do it? You want to go do it? You want to go do it? And then they just like, they were stoned, so they didn't. The reason, you know, and, you know, he asked McCartney this a couple times, this journalist, I guess McCartney kind of trusts the guy. But he asked him, you know, well, why didn't you? And the basic answer was, I think that, and he didn't say this. No, he did specifically say this. They were kind of scared that they would screw up the everything they'd done before by doing some shitty thing.
Yeah.
That didn't live up to it. It's like, we had a time where everything worked and it just came flowing out of us, and that's over. And I don't want to mess with it again. I don't want to touch it. I don't want to go back to it.
Well, they could have shown up there and half-assed sucked, and everybody would have loved them. But, you know, they're serious about the music and didn't want to do that.
Yeah. I mean, they could have done it and been silly and all that. And I think three of them played at, like, Eric Clapton's wedding. Minus John Lennon, and everybody there said it was terrible.
Yeah, they came together and did the album and stuff, but the vibe was never there, you know? It's just they realized that it was time to move on.
Yeah, and they just really... And I didn't know how much George Harrison hated McCartney. I didn't realize, because he's never really made a big deal out of it in public, I don't think, but apparently he just hated his guts for a while, so...
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, that's the... deal with there's a reason they broke up. You spend, you know, how many years they spend together on living in the same room and bus or whatever. It's like after a while, you know, and you have your little, it's like a family. Oh, okay, I can handle Thanksgiving, but
gets on your nerves after a while.
Well, it's incredibly the dynamic of playing with other musicians.
Yeah.
And
which Adam Gorightly knows about. I do not know this. So
yeah, me and Joe, we got a good simpaticos, but it's being, you know, even then you're dealing with things. Everybody has their ideas of, and they want a certain role in the thing,
yeah.
And you know, you bring certain individuals together. It's just a tough deal to maintain. It's amazing they maintained what they did for as long as they did, you know?
Yeah.
And accomplished what they did. You know, they were happy with that. And some of the music they did after, I fucking really dig McCartney's early stuff, Ram, and especially Ram, and even Band on the Run was good. I can't stomach any of it now. Paul Kimball loves all the later stuff, but...
I like just about all the 70s stuff, but yeah, Ram's my favorite. I listened to that album every night for a year, one year when I was in high school.
Yeah, that's cool. It just has that, and he played, I think on that album, he's playing all the instruments himself. And
Most of them. He did have session musicians come in. They recorded it in New York some session musicians, and it was... It was made to be extremely polished, and, you know, it wasn't supposed to be some thrown-together thing.
On the same note, the other Beatles around that time did good stuff, too, that they wouldn't have done as Beatles, you know, like... I like that Lennon Plastic Ono Band. It's kind of the sparse sound.
Yeah.
And so that was cool. And so at some point, as musicians, too, you kind of run out of... stuff, you know, they were young and full of vigor, and they those juices, you can't always count on the muse to come forth, and at some point
that's kind of how I feel about the magazine, and everything was going then, and you know, it was just some point in my life, myself particularly, that everything was firing on, felt like it was firing on all cylinders, to the point of which I felt like this energy pushing me along that was coming from inside me, and I didn't know where it came from or what was causing it, but it kept pushing me really fast. So
I hear people chortling in the distance.
Yeah, it's perfect. One time we were doing a show here and people were arguing out on the street. It was great. There was like, I think there was almost a fight. And it was loud enough that whoever was in the studio anyway stuck their head out of the window and said, "Shut up!"
Oh, I think I heard that. I think it was Nick.
Oh, was it Nick? Yes, you're right, it was.
The last time Nick was there, I tuned in for the live version. I don't know if you posted that yet. And he was going, there's some fighting or something going out to Greg. And you said, whatever, it's fine. Okay. That was my Nick Redfern.
Yes. Yeah, my Nick Redfern impersonation is only two words. Project Beta.
Well, it's like the British, too. They say for process, it's process.
Yes, aluminium.
Okay, aren't you quite... You're pretty full of yourself. Project Beta. And there's a certain process. That's why they sound so much smarter than we are in the...
Yeah, I mean, people listening to BBC automatically assume the news coming from there is more intelligent and better than any news coming out of the United States. So,
well, it probably is.
At this point, it might be, actually.
Jesus fucking Christ. I want to tune into... I used to enjoy, and I'm not going to watch Fox, but the headline news, and that concept is fucking gone. Once they... latch on to the missing plane, or now we got this the hot car dad who that becomes the goddamn story, and it's like, oh
yeah, nothing else is going on for some reason,
and there's so much you can handle that's pretty negative fucking story, dumbass leaving his kid in the car to die, but taking the interview into a negative space here. What else do you want to talk about?
It's negative. It's negativity, man. Kimball posted something about the apotheosis of Twee. It was an article in the Atlantic and
Tweeg?
No, Twee, T W E E. Something that's just
talking the Dodgers.
No, something that's just so precious and stylized. And as examples, they use, what's his name, Wes Anderson films, which earlier on, I would agree with you, Holden Caulfield, the whole thing. Anyway.
What now? Wait a minute. I'm not grasping all this. The apotheosis of who?
Twee. T-W-E-E.
And what's that mean, basically?
It means something that's sort of hot... hipstery, precious, and highbrow or pseudo highbrow, and I can't think of any other words. Think of
okay, I got you. Informed a generation.
Well, sort of, but they're saying it's coming back, and it's led by people such as Wes Anderson and Zooey Deschanel.
I don't know who those people are.
Oh, okay, never mind. Anyway,
well, I mean, who are they? Are they made Wes? Who's Wes?
Well,
Anderson?
Wes Anderson is a filmmaker. He just finished the latest film, which is not Twee at all. I don't think is Grand Budapest Hotel.
Okay, I haven't seen that. So.
He also...
I'm usually like 20 years behind the times. I'll see the movie when I'm 73, and I'll be there crying. It's like, fuck, man. I'm just learning about Wes Anderson now.
Yeah. What other film? What's it? Life Aquatic, the one with Bill Murray.
I thought that was,
Yeah, see? You would agree with this guy then. I really enjoyed that film. But anyway, the idea was that precious eccentricity thing. Had gone too far and it was taking over culture, and I was like, you know what? That's exactly what that's basically the end game of NPR, which is why I can't stand it.
Yeah,
I can't stand the NPR thing.
About NPR, there's that voice on NPR, and it's usually the guy who's talking on the. They all sound the same. They
Have Noah, whatever his name is.
Know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Maybe they run them through some kind of mixer, so they all have that same sound of that kind of. There's almost a snootiness there, but
they care about they care about the environment, and they care about social issues, and they care about, and yes, we all care about those things. But the point is it's so stylized and so, I mean, maybe I have this wrong, but it seems like the kind of person that listens to that is somebody that lives in, like in Santa Monica or San Francisco, that it's extremely insulated from that kind of stuff. But, oh, they really do care about it, and, oh, they really do think that all this weird stuff is interesting. And maybe they do, but it just, for some reason, that take on it annoys me. Because people think it's like guilty liberal stations. Like, oh, you must be some conservative asshole. It's like, no, that has nothing to do with it. That is not what I'm saying.
Give me Gene Shepard or Art Bell or any of those guys, you know, in their heyday.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know whose heyday it is now or who I would listen to. I'm just like you now. I'm listening to all the old shit.
Well, there's a few people doing good stuff. I mean, I like your show. You're not a storyteller per se like Gene Shepard.
Who is one of my main heroes, as you know.
You know who has done some good stuff over the years? And he is my friend Visigoth. And, you know, he was into the whole conspiracy thing back in the day. But then he's done other things where it was just cool. He was telling stories. He did this whole series. And he'll record and put this stuff on the web. Then he'll pull it down after a while. But he's going through different phases of life. And he was going through this period where he was early in the morning, you know, he couldn't sleep or whatever, so he's in there in Florida, and he'd drive to the post office because he was getting cranky in his older years, and he didn't like going to the post office during the heavy hours because he'd have to deal with assholes.
Yeah.
So he'd like to show up there and get his mail, then he'd drive back and forth, so he's recording his conversations about his thoughts about the world and reminiscing about stuff. And occasionally there was one thing he did where it had rained that day, and he's out on this muddy road in his pickup truck, and he's telling a story about living in New York back in the day. Then he sees this guy up ahead of him and said, oh, this asshole here needs to speed up, you know, the road's muddy, and like, oh, he's gonna fuck me over, and okay, here, I'm going to have to fucking gun it to get around this guy. And okay, here we go, sports fans. Hang on. And you rev the engine and get around the guy. See you later, asshole. And he has these great stories about growing up or whatever. So
he's a
treasure, you know. So there's people out there can do it, but you're not going to – it's not like Gene Shepard or Long John Neville or whoever back in the day where
– yeah.
You had this late night audience. Even Larry King was, of all people.
Yeah.
I used to listen to him years ago before TV and all that, and he had all these great stories he would tell.
Yeah. I mean, if somebody can just walk in there with little or no preparation and just start telling you a story, that's really, and keep your attention night after night, that's extremely rare.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. God, I like doing, when I was doing the podcast, I enjoyed doing that, but I couldn't, you know, trying to do that is just way beyond me, and it's a rare talent, you know, to, especially by yourself.
yeah, exactly. Oh, Carlos says, yes, I too have come to loathe NPR.
Oh, yeah, I quit. God, I don't listen to it.
I work for them for about 4 months. I work for Marketplace, which isn't quite NPR, but it's sort of in the same vein.
Well, it's funny about that.
NPR, and I like the people I worked with, and I liked working at the station and all that. It's just that I don't like the NPR, you know, kind of the vibe at the mainstream NPR, I guess you call it.
Well, and it seems there's a political correctness there as well.
If you put Tony Clifton in the middle of NPR, it'd be like setting off an atom bomb.
Oh, yeah. No, they're not going to invite Tony Clifton to come into the studio. That wouldn't last too long.
No. It's a little after 10. Do you want to keep going, or do you want me to play this? I downloaded two albums by this comedian, John Mulaney, who I've heard for a while, and I just bought two of his albums, and I am peeing myself with laughter.
Oh, we can wrap it up.
Okay.
You probably want to get home if you want to.
Oh, I don't care about getting home. I was wondering if you wanted to keep talking, because if you do, I will. That's fine.
No, let's wrap it up.
Okay,
this has been a good one.
I've had the laughs, which means it was a good show. The book is Historia Discordia.
Yes, The Origins of the Discordian Society.
Where is that available, Mr. Adam Gorightly?
Everything is Amazon these days. it can be had in bookstores and ordered from bookstores, but you know, you're not going to find it
everywhere,
in a bookstore unless you order it. And the publisher kind of felt that way, and I agreed with him to spend money and put it on the shelves because this is such a niche type thing that our audience was really on them internets.
Your CIA mind control training shows its worthiness.
Okay. And there's actually another book coming out that's from the archives, and Feral House is going to publish it.
Oh, okay.
Adam Parfrey.
Yeah, I haven't heard from Parfrey in a while.
Yeah, this is called, all these titles are long, and it's changed, but it's Caught in the Crossfire, Kerry Thornley, Oswald, and the Garrison Investigation.
Ah, perfect.
And it's coming out in October of this year.
Of course it is.
And it's an expansion on the stuff I covered, wrote about in The Prankster and The Conspiracy, but it gets more into the weeds about the whole Garrison Investigation, how it impacted Thornley's life. And I found some cool, crazy, a lot of new material, which led to the book project through the archives, and as well as I've had Tim Cridland, of all people. Tim's
always in there. He's like in the background there, like pulling strings and making things happen. It's amazing.
Well, he's interested in a lot of this. He's interested in Thornley and this, the Garrison Investigation. He goes out to New Orleans, and he was going out there on a tour doing his Zamora the Torture King thing, and he said, "Hey, I'm going to be out there." And of course, he likes to spend his off hours researching shit, going into museums, libraries, anywhere where they got old files that nobody's dug into in years. So he as well found some interesting new amazing stuff.
There's your last, third and last...
Well, this is some kind of record. Hilaris!
There it goes. That is perfect fade out.
So, yeah, I wanted to mention Tim Cridland?
Yes, Cridland.
Cridland. And I heard
Aluminium.
The show you did with him a while back, and that's one of my favorites that you've... done, because he's a really top-notch researcher, old-school researcher who is willing to and enjoys just, digging up that stuff. He has a knack for it, for sure.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks so much, Adam Gorightly, and I will talk to you soon, and if you can make it down for the whichever day you want for the a baseball game, we will do that.
Okay, yeah, I'm waiting.
Waiting for an answer back on a day?
Uh-huh. Okay. And Groucho Gandhi says, "Hey, guys, great show." Oh, and you said thanks. Okay,
yes, I see I about every 5 or 10 minutes, I will look at the Facebook feed and see what people are saying.
Yeah, I never know. I never listen to these things back because I hate my voice, but I think this was a good one, so thanks.
All right, thanks. You want to stay on and listen to this this little piece of comedy? It has to do with music, so you will like it.
I'll listen to it on the internet.
Oh, okay.
Take care, Greg.
All right, thanks. You too. Talk to you soon.
I want to tell you one story. This was the best meal I've ever had in my life, all right? This happened when I was 11 years old in Chicago, Illinois, where I grew up, and it took place at a little restaurant called the Salt and Pepper Diner, which was a family restaurant in the city. Yes, yes, you know the Salt and Pepper Diner? It's a wonderful family restaurant in Chicago, which means that it caters mainly to teenagers and homeless schizophrenics. Now, I go into this place one day when I'm 11 with my best friend, John. And I should say that his name is also John. I'm not calling myself my own best friend. It's a separate human being. We walk into the Salt and Pepper Diner one day, and they had a jukebox there, all right? And the jukebox was 3 plays for $1. So we put in $7 and selected 21 plays of Tom Jones's What's New Pussycat. And then we ordered and waited. Here's the thing about when What's New Pussycat plays over and over and over and over and over again. The second time it plays, your immediate thought is not, hey, someone's playing What's New Pussycat again. It's, hey, What's New Pussycat is a lot longer than I first thought. And it has like a dip in the middle. You know how some songs have a dip, like Guns N' Roses' November Rain? You're like, hey, November Rain's over. No, it's not. There's more. The third time it plays, you're thinking, maybe someone's playing What's New Pussycat again. The fourth time it plays, you're thinking, whoa. Someone just played What's New Pussycat four times. Or at least, someone played it twice, and it's a really long song. So, the fifth time is the kicker. Now, we're watching the entire diner at this point. Most people have gotten wind as to what's going on. And we're staring at this one guy, and he's sitting in his booth, and his, like, hand is shaking while his stupid kids jump around, and, like, he's been onto us since the beginning. And he's staring at his coffee cup like this, and he has this look on his face like, aw, like he just got his 30-day chip from anger management. And he's staring like this, and the fourth play fades out. It's dead quiet. And then, I don't know if you know this, but the song begins very subtly. Blah, blah, What's New Pussycat? And the guy goes, God damn it! And pounds on the table, and silverware flies everywhere, and it was fantastic. But a word about my friend John and what a genius he was. Because when we were first up at the jukebox and we were punching in the What's New Pussycats, right? I punched in about 7. And then John says to me, hey, 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 wait. Before we drop in another What's New Pussycat, let's put in one It's Not Unusual. And that is when the afternoon went from good to great. After 7 What's New Pussycats in a row, suddenly... Dum da dum dum na 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 na. It's not unusual. And the sigh of relief that swept through the diner. People were ecstatic. It was like the liberation of France. You know, for years scientists have wondered, can you make grown men and women weep tears of joy by playing Tom Jones's It's Not Unusual? And the answer is yes, you can. As long as it is preceded by 7 What's New Pussycats. And on the other hand, when we went back. Holy shit. It's Not Unusual fades out. It's dead quiet. What's new, pussycat? People went fucking insane. No one could handle it. No one could handle it. And they were surrounded by this, like, seemingly indifferent staff, you know, that was just like, yep, same shit as always. My only wish is that one of the schizophrenics had stood up and been like, now you know. Now you know what it's like to live in my brain. They unplugged the jukebox after 11 plays. And that was the best meal I've ever had. Thank you very much, San Francisco.